That's on my account. Well, at least I could come home one time without finding Ben and that nigger hanging on the gate like a bear and a monkey in the same cage. Just let it come toward sundown, and he'd head for the gate like a cow for the barn, hanging on to it and bobbing his head and sort of moaning to himself. That's a hog for punishment for you. If what had happened to him for fooling with open gates had happened to me, I never would want to see another one. I often wondered what he'd be thinking about down there at the gate, watching the girls going home from school, trying to want something he couldn't even remember he didn't and couldn't want any longer, and what he'd think when they'd be undressing him and he'd happen to take a look at himself and begin to cry like he'd do. But like I say, they never did enough of that. I says, I know what you need. You need what they did to Ben, then you'd behave. And if you don't know what that was, I says, ask Dilsey to tell you. There was a light in Mother's room. I put the car up and went on into the kitchen. Luster and Ben were there. Where's Dilsey, I says, putting supper on? She upstairs with Miss Caroline, Luster says. They been going it, ever since Miss Quinton come home. Mammy up there keeping them from fighting. Is that show come, Mr. Jason? Yes, I says. I thought I heard the band, he says. Wish I could go, he says. I could if I just had a quarter. Dilsey came in. You come, is you? She says. What you been up to this evening? You knows how much work I got to do. Why don't you get here on time? Maybe I went to the show, I says. Is supper ready? Wish I could go, Luster says. I could if I just had a quarter. You ain't got no business at no show, Dilsey says. You go on in the house and sit down, she says. Don't you go upstairs and get 'em started again now. What's the matter? I says. Quentin come in a while ago and says you've been following her around all evening, and then Miss Caroline jumped on her. Why don't you let her alone? Can't you live in the same house with your own blood niece without quarreling? I can't quarrel with her, I says, because I haven't seen her since this morning. What does she say I've done now, made her go to school? That's pretty bad, I says. Well, you tend to your business and let her alone, Dilsey says. I'll take care of her, if you and Miss Caroline will let me. Go on in, darn, now, and behave yourself till I get supper on. If I just had a quarter, Luster says, I could go to that show. And if you had wings, you could fly to heaven, Dilsey says. I don't want to hear another word about that show. That reminds me, I says, I got a couple of tickets they gave me. I took them out of my coat. You fixin' to use 'em? Luster says. Not me, I says. I wouldn't go to it for $10. Give me one of 'em, Mr. Jason, he says. I'll sell you one, I says. How about it? I ain't got no money, he says. That's too bad, I says. I made to go out. Give me one of 'em, Mr. Jason, he says. You ain't gwine need 'em both. Hush your mouth, Dilsey says. Don't you know he ain't gwine give nothing away? How much you want for it, he says. 5 cents, I says. I ain't got that much, he says. How much you got, I says. I ain't got nothing, he says. All right, I says. I went on. Mr. Jason, he says. Why don't you hush up, Dilsey says. He just teasing you. He fixing to use them tickets hisself. Go on, Jason, and let him loan. I don't want them, I says. I came back to the stove. I came in here to burn them up. But if you want to buy one for a nickel, I says, looking at him and opening the stove lid. I ain't got that much, he says. All right, I says. I dropped one of them in the stove. You, Jason, Dilsey says, ain't you shamed? Mr. Jason, he says, please, sir, I'll fix them tires every day for a month. I need the cash, I says. You can have it for a nickel. Hush, Luster, Dilsey says. She jerked him back. Go on, she says, drop it in, go on, get it over with. You can have it for a nickel, I says. Go on, Dilsey says, he ain't got no nickel, go on, drop it in. All right, I says. I dropped it in and Dilsey shut the stove. A big growed man like you, she says, get on out my kitchen. Hush, she says to Luster, don't you get Benji started. I'll get you a quarter from Phony tonight and you can go tomorrow night. Hush up now. I went on into the living room. I couldn't hear anything from upstairs. I opened the paper. After a while, Ben and Luster came in. Ben went to the dark place on the wall where the mirror used to be, rubbing his hands on it and slobbering and moaning. Luster begun punching at the fire. What are you doing? I says. We don't need any fire tonight. I'm trying to keep him quiet, he says. "'He'd always called Easter,' he says. "'Only this is not Easter,' I says. "'Let it alone.' He put the poker back and got the cushion out of Mother's chair and gave it to Ben, and he hunkered down in front of the fireplace and got quiet. I read the paper. There hadn't been a sound from upstairs when Dilsey came in and sent Ben and Luster onto the kitchen and said supper was ready. "'All right,' I says. She went out. I sat there reading the paper. After a while, I heard Dilsey looking in at the door. "'Why don't you come on and eat?' she says. "'I'm waiting for supper,' I says. "'It's on the table,' she says. "'I done told you.' "'Is it?' I says. "'Excuse me, I didn't hear anybody come down.' "'They ain't coming,' she says. "'You come on and eat so I can take something up to them.' "'Are they sick?' I says. "'What did the doctor say it was? Not smallpox, I hope.' "'Come on here, Jason,' she says, "'so I can get done.' "'All right,' I says, raising the paper again. "'I'm waiting for supper now.' I could feel her watching me at the door. I read the paper. "'What you want to act like this for?' she says, "'when you knows how much bother I has anyway. "'If Mother's any sicker than she was when she came down to dinner, all right,' I says. "'But as long as I am buying food for people younger than I am, "'they'll have to come down to the table to eat it. "'Let me know when supper's ready,' I says, reading the paper again. "'I heard her climbing the stairs, "'dragging her feet and grunting and groaning "'like they were straight up and 3 feet apart. "'I heard her at Mother's door, "'then I heard her calling Quentin, "'like the door was locked. "'Then she went back to Mother's room, "'and then Mother went and talked to Quentin. "'Then they came downstairs. "'I read the paper. "'Dilsey came back to the door. "'Come on,' she says, "'fore you can think up some old devilment. "'You just trying yourself tonight.' "'I went to the dining room. "'Quentin was sitting with her head bent. "'She had painted her face again. "'Her nose looked like a porcelain insulator. "'I'm glad you feel well enough to come down,' I says to Mother. "'It's little enough I can do for you to come to the table,' she says, "'no matter how I feel. "'I realize that when a man works all day, "'he likes to be surrounded by his family at the supper table. "'I want to please you. "'I only wish you and Quentin got along better. "'It would be easier for me.' "'We get along all right,' I says. "'I don't mind her staying locked up in her room all day if she wants to. "'But I can't have all this whoop-to-do and sulking at meal times. "'I know that's a lot to ask her, but I'm that way in my own house. "'Your house, I meant to say. "'It's yours,' Mother says. "'You are the head of it now.' "'Quentin hadn't looked up. "'I helped the plates, and she begun to eat. "'Did you get a good piece of meat?' I says. "'If you didn't, I'll try to find you a better one.' She didn't say anything. I say, did you get a good piece of meat? I says. What? She says, yes, it's all right. Will you have some more rice? I says. No, she says. Better let me give you some more, I says. I don't want any more, she says. Not at all, I says. You're welcome. Is your headache gone? Mother says. Headache, I says. "'I was afraid you were developing one,' she says, "'when you came in this afternoon.' "'Oh,' I says, "'no, it didn't show up. "'We stayed so busy this afternoon, I forgot about it.' "'Was that why you were late?' Mother says. "'I could see Quentin listening. "'I looked at her. "'Her knife and fork were still gone, but I caught her looking at me. "'Then she looked at her plate again. "'I says, "'No, I loaned my car to a fellow about 3 o'clock, "'and I had to wait until he got back with it. "'I ate for a while.' "'Who was it?' Mother says. "'It was one of those show men,' I says. "'It seems his sister's husband was out riding with some town woman, and he was chasing them.' Quentin sat perfectly still, chewing. "'You ought not to lend your car to people like that,' Mother says. "'You are too generous with it. "'That's why I never call on you for it if I can help it.' "'I was beginning to think that myself for a while,' I says, "'but he got back all right.' "'He says he found what he was looking for.' "'Who was the woman?' Mother says. "'I'll tell you later,' I says. "'I don't like to talk about such things before Quentin.' Quentin had quit eating. Every once in a while she'd take a drink of water, then she'd sit there crumbling a biscuit up, her face bent over her plate. "'Yes,' Mother says. "'I suppose women who stay shut up like I do have no idea what goes on in this town.' "'Yes,' I says, "'they don't. "'My life has been so different from that,' Mother says. "'Thank God I don't know about such wickedness. "'I don't even want to know about it. I'm not like most people. I didn't say any more. Quentin sat there, crumbling the biscuit until I quit eating. Then she says, "Can I go now?" without looking at anybody. "What?" I said, "Sure you can go. Were you waiting on us?" She looked at me. She had crumpled all the bread, but her hands still went on like they were crumpling it yet, and her eyes looked like they were cornered or something. And then she started biting her mouth like it ought to have poisoned her with all that red lead.
"Grandmother," she says, "grandmother."
"Did you want something else to eat?" I says.
"Why does he treat me like this, grandmother?" she says. "I never hurt him."
"I want you all to get along with one another," mother says. "You are all that's left now, and I do want you all to get along better."
"It's his fault," she says. "He won't let me alone, and I have to. If he doesn't want me here, why won't he let me go back to—"
"That's enough," I says. "Not another word."
"Then why won't he let me alone?" she says. He is the nearest thing to a father you've ever had," mother says. "It's his bread you and I eat. It's only right that he should expect obedience from you." "It's his fault," she says.
She jumped up.
"He makes me do it. If he would just—"
She looked at us, her eyes cornered, kind of jerking her arms against her sides.
"If I would just what?" I says.
"Whatever I do, it's your fault," she says. "If I'm bad, it's because I had to be. You made me. I wish I was dead. I wish we were all dead."
Then she ran. We heard her run up the stairs. Then a door slammed. "That's the first sensible thing she ever said," I says.
"She didn't go to school today," mother says.
"How do you know?" I says. "Were you downtown?"
"I just know," she says. "I wish you could be kinder to her."
"If I did that, I'd have to arrange to see her more than once a day," I says. "You'll have to make her come to the table every meal. Then I could give her an extra piece of meat every time."
"There are little things you could do," she says.
"Like not paying any attention when you ask me to see that she goes to school?" I says.
"She didn't go to school today," she says. "I just know she didn't. She says she went for a car ride with one of the boys this afternoon and you followed her."
"How could I?" I says, "when somebody had my car all afternoon." "Whether or not she was in school today is already past," I says. "If you've got to worry about it, worry about next Monday."
"I wanted you and she to get along with one another," she says. "But she has inherited all of the headstrong traits. Quentin's, too. I thought at the time, with the heritage she would already have, to give her that name, too. Sometimes I think she is the judgment of both of them upon me."
"Good Lord," I says, "you've got a fine mind. No wonder you keep yourself sick all the time."
"What?" she says. "I don't understand."
"I hope not," I says. "A good woman misses a lot. She's better off without knowing."
"They were both that way," she says. "They would make interest with your father against me when I tried to correct them. He was always saying they didn't need controlling, that they already knew what cleanliness and honesty were, which was all that anyone could hope to be taught. And now I hope he's satisfied."
"You've got Ben to depend on," I says. "Cheer up."
"They deliberately shut me out of their lives," she says. "It was always her and Quentin. They were always conspiring against me. Against you, too, though you were too young to realize it. They always looked on you and me as outsiders, like they did your Uncle Maury. I always told your father that they were allowed too much freedom, to be together too much. When Quentin started to school, we had to let her go the next year so she could be with him. She couldn't bear for any of you to do anything she couldn't. It was vanity in her, vanity and false pride. And then when her troubles began, I knew that Quentin would feel that he had to do something just as bad. But I didn't believe that he would have been so selfish as to. I didn't dream that he—"
"Maybe he knew it was going to be a girl," I says, "and that one more of them would be more than he could stand."
"He could have controlled her," she says. "He seemed to be the only person she had any consideration for. But that is part of the judgment, too, I suppose."
"Yes," I says. "Too bad it wasn't me instead of him. You'd be a lot better off."
"You say things like that to hurt me," she says. "I deserve it, though. When they began to sell the land to send Quentin to Harvard, I told your father that he must make an equal provision for you. Then when Herbert offered to take you into the bank, I said, 'Jason is provided for now.
and when all the expense began to pile up and I was forced to sell our furniture and the rest of the pasture. I wrote her at once because I said she will realize that she and Quentin have had their share and part of Jason's too, and that it depends on her now to compensate him. I said she will do that out of respect for her father. I believed that then, but I'm just a poor old woman. I was raised to believe that people would deny themselves for their own flesh and blood. It's my fault. You were right to reproach me.
"Do you think I need any man's help to stand on my feet?" I says, "let alone a woman that can't name the father of her own child."
"Jason," she says.
"All right," I says, "I didn't mean that, of course not."
"If I believed that were possible, after all my suffering."
"Of course it's not," I says, "I didn't mean it."
"I hope that at least is spared me," she says.
"Sure it is," I says, "she's too much like both of them to doubt that."
"I couldn't bear that," she says.
"Then quit thinking about it," I says. "Has she been worrying you any more about getting out at night?"
"No. I made her realize that it was for her own good, and that she'd thank me for it some day. She takes her books with her and studies after I lock the door. I see the light on as late as 11 o'clock some nights."
"How do you know she's studying?" I says.
"I don't know what else she'd do in there alone," she says. "She never did read any."
"No," I says, "you wouldn't know, and you can thank your stars for that," I says. "Only what would be the use in saying it aloud? It would just have her crying on me again." I heard her go upstairs. Then she called Quentin, and Quentin says, "What?" through the door.
"Good night," Mother says.
Then I heard the key in the lock, and Mother went back to her room. When I finished my cigar and went up, the light was still on. I could see the empty keyhole, but I couldn't hear a sound. She studied quiet. Maybe she learned that in school. I told Mother good night and went on to my room and got the box out and counted it again. I could hear the Great American Gelding snoring away like a planing mill. I read somewhere they'd fix men that way to give them women's voices. But maybe he didn't know what they'd done to him. I don't reckon he even knew what he had been trying to do or why Mr. Burgess knocked him out with the fence picket. And if they'd just sent him on to Jackson while he was under the ether, he'd never have known the difference. But that would have been too simple for a Compson to think of. Not half complex enough. Having to wait to do it all until he broke out and tried to run a little girl down on the street with her own father looking at him. Well, like I say, they never started soon enough with their cutting, and they quit too quick. I know at least two more that needed something like that, and one of them not over a mile away either. But then I don't reckon even that would do any good. Like I say, once a bitch, always a bitch. And just let me have 24 hours without any damn New York Jew to advise me what it's going to do. I don't want to make a killing. Save that to suck in the smart gamblers with. I just want an even chance to get my money back. And once I've done that, they can bring all Beale Street and all Bedlam in here, and two of them can sleep in my bed, and another one can have my place at the table, too.
April 8th, 1928. The day dawned bleak and chill, a moving wall of gray light out of the northeast, which, instead of dissolving into moisture, seemed to disintegrate into minute and venomous particles, like dust that, when Dilsey opened the door of the cabin and emerged, needled laterally into her flesh, precipitating not so much a moisture as a substance, partaking of the quality of thin, not quite congealed oil. She wore a stiff black straw hat perched upon her turban, and a maroon velvet cape with a border of mangy and anonymous fur above a dress of purple silk. And she stood in the door for a while with her myriad and sunken face lifted to the weather, and one gaunt hand flax-soled as the belly of a fish. Then she moved the cape aside and examined the bosom of her gown. The gown fell gauntly from her shoulders, across her fallen breasts, then tightened upon her paunch and fell again, ballooning a little above the nether garments, which she would remove layer by layer as the spring accomplished and the warm days, in color regal and moribund. She had been a big woman once, but now her skeleton rose, draped loosely in unpadded skin that tightened again upon a paunch almost dropsical, as though muscle and tissue had been courage or fortitude, which the days or the years had consumed, until only the indomitable skeleton was left, rising like a ruin or a landmark above the somnolent and impervious guts.
and above that the collapsed face that gave the impression of the bones themselves being outside the flesh, lifted into the driving day with an expression at once fatalistic and of a child's astonished disappointment, until she turned and entered the house again and closed the door. The earth immediately about the door was bare. It had a patina, as though from the soles of bare feet in generations, like old silver or the walls of Mexican houses which have been plastered by hand. Beside the house, shading it in summer, stood three mulberry trees, the fledged leaves that would later be broad and placid as the palms of hands, streaming flatly undulant upon the driving air. A pair of jaybirds came up from nowhere, whirled up on the blast like gaudy scraps of cloth or paper and lodged in the mulberries, where they swung in raucous tilt and recover, screaming into the wind that ripped their harsh cries onward and away like scraps of paper or of cloth in turn. Then three more joined them, and they swung and tilted in the rung branches for a time, screaming. The door of the cabin opened, and Dilsey emerged once more, this time in a man's felt hat and an army overcoat, beneath the frayed skirts of which her blue gingham dress fell in uneven balloonings, streaming too about her as she crossed the yard and mounted the steps to the kitchen door. A moment later she emerged, carrying an open umbrella now, which she slanted ahead into the wind, and crossed to the woodpile and laid the umbrella down, still open. Immediately she caught at it and arrested it and held to it for a while, looking about her. Then she closed it and laid it down and stacked stovewood into her crooked arm, against her breast, and picked up the umbrella and got it open at last and returned to the steps and held the wood precariously balanced while she contrived to close the umbrella, which she propped in the corner just within the door. She dumped the wood into the box behind the stove. Then she removed the overcoat and hat and took a soiled apron down from the wall and put it on and built a fire in the stove. While she was doing so, rattling the great bars and clattering the lids, Mrs. Compson began to call her from the head of the stairs. She wore a dressing gown of quilted black satin, holding it close under her chin. In the other hand, she held a red rubber hot water bottle, and she stood at the head of the back stairway, calling Dilsey at steady and inflectionless intervals into the quiet stairwell that descended into complete darkness, then opened again where a gray window fell across it. Dilsey, she called without inflection or emphasis or haste, as though she were not listening for a reply at all. Dilsey. Dilsey answered and ceased clattering the stove, but before she could cross the kitchen, Mrs. Compson called her again, and before she crossed the dining room and brought her head into relief against the gray splash of the window, still again. All right, Dilsey said, all right, here I is. I'll fill it soon as I get some hot water. She gathered up her skirts and mounted the stairs, wholly blotting the gray light. Put it down, darn, gone back to bed. I couldn't understand what was the matter, Mrs. Compson said. I've been lying awake for an hour, at least, without hearing a sound from the kitchen. You put it down and go on back to bed, Dilsey said. She toiled painfully up the steps, shapeless, breathing heavily. I'll have the fire gwine in a minute, and the water hot in two mo'. I've been lying there for an hour, at least, Mrs. Compson said. I thought maybe you were waiting for me to come down and start the fire. Dilsey reached the top of the stairs and took the water bottle. "I'll fix it in a minute," she said. "Luster overslept this morning, up half the night at that show. I gwine build the fire myself. Go on now, so you won't wake the others twell I ready." "If you permit Luster to do things that interfere with his work, you'll have to suffer for it yourself," Mrs. Compson said. "Jason won't like this if he hears about it. You know he won't." "'Twasn't none of Jason's money he went on," Dilsey said. "That's one thing, sure." She went on down the stairs. Mrs. Compson returned to her room. As she got into bed again, she could hear Dilsey yet descending the stairs with a sort of painful and terrific slowness that would have become maddening had it not presently ceased beyond the flapping diminishment of the pantry door. She entered the kitchen and built up the fire and began to prepare breakfast. In the midst of this, she ceased and went to the window and looked out toward her cabin. Then she went to the door and opened it and shouted into the driving weather. "'Luster!' she shouted, standing to listen, tilting her face from the wind. "'You, Luster!' She listened. Then, as she prepared to shout again, Luster appeared around the corner of the kitchen. "'Ma'am?' he said innocently, so innocently that Dilsey looked down at him, for a moment motionless, with something more than mere surprise. "Where are you at?" she said.
"Nowhere," he said, "just in the cellar."
"What you doing in the cellar?" she said. "Don't stand there in the rain, fool," she said.
"Ain't doing nothing," he said.
He came up the steps.
"Don't you dare come in this door without an armful of wood," she said. "Here I done had to tote your wood and build your fire both. Didn't I tell you not to leave this place last night before that wood box was full to the top?"
"I did," Luster said. "I filled it."
"Whar it gone to then?"
"I don't know, I ain't touched it."
"Well, you get it full up now," she said, "and get on up there and see about Benji."
She shut the door. Luster went to the woodpile. The 5 jaybirds whirled over the house, screaming, and into the mulberries again. He watched them. He picked up a rock and threw it.
"Who?" he said. "Get on back to hell where you belong at. 'Tain't Monday yet."
He loaded himself mountainously with stove wood. He could not see over it, and he staggered to the steps and up them and blundered, crashing against the door, shedding billets. Then Dilsey came and opened the door for him, and he blundered across the kitchen.
"You Luster!" she shouted, but he had already hurled the wood into the box with a thunderous crash.
"Ha!" he said.
"Is you trying to wake up the whole house?"
Dilsey said. She hit him on the back of his head with the flat of her hand.
"Go on up there and get Benji dressed now."
"Yes'm," he said.
He went toward the outer door.
"Why you gwine?" Dilsey said.
"I thought I'd better go round the house and in by the front so I won't wake up Miss Caroline and them."
"You go on up them back stairs like I told you and get Benji's clothes on him," Dilsey said. "Go on now."
"Yes'm," Luster said.
He returned and left by the dining room door. After a while, it ceased to flap. Dilsey prepared to make biscuit. As she ground the sifter steadily above the breadboard, she sang, to herself at first, something without particular tune or words, repetitive, mournful and plaintive, austere, as she ground a faint, steady snowing of flour onto the breadboard. The stove had begun to heat the room and to fill it with murmurous minors of the fire, and presently she was singing louder, as if her voice too had been thawed out by the growing warmth. And then Mrs. Compson called her name again from within the house. Dilsey raised her face as if her eyes could and did penetrate the walls and ceiling, and saw the old woman in her quilted dressing gown at the head of the stairs, calling her name with machine-like regularity.
"Oh, Lord," Dilsey said.
She set the sifter down and swept up the hem of her apron and wiped her hands, and caught up the bottle from the chair on which she had laid it, and gathered her apron about the handle of the kettle, which was now jetting faintly.
"Just a minute," she called. "The water just this minute got hot."
It was not the bottle which Mrs. Compson wanted, however, and clutching it by the neck like a dead hen, Dilsey went to the foot of the stairs and looked upward.
"Ain't Luster up there with him?" she said.
"Luster hasn't been in the house. I've been lying here listening for him. I knew he would be late, but I did hope he'd come in time to keep Benjamin from disturbing Jason on Jason's one day in the week to sleep in the morning."
"I don't see how you expect anybody to sleep when you standin' in the hall hollin' at folks from the crack of dawn," Dilsey said.
She began to mount the stairs, toiling heavily.
"I saw that boy up dar half an hour ago."
Mrs. Compson watched her, holding the dressing gown under her chin.
"What are you goin' to do?" she said.
"Gwine to get Benji dressed and bring him down to the kitchen while he won't wake Jason and Quentin," Dilsey said.
"Haven't you started breakfast yet?"
"I'll tend to that, too," Dilsey said. "You better get back in bed twell Luster make your fire. It cold this morning."
"I know it," Mrs. Compson said. "My feet are like ice. They were so cold they waked me up."
She watched Dilsey mount the stairs. It took her a long while.
"You know how it frets Jason when breakfast is late," Mrs. Compson said. "I can't do but one thing at a time," Dilsey said. "You get on back to bed, for I has you on my hands this morning, too.
If you're going to drop everything to dress Benjamin, I'd better come down and get breakfast. You know as well as I do how Jason acts when it's late."
"And who gwine eat your messin'?" Dilsey said. "Tell me that."
"Go on now," she said, toiling upward.
Mrs. Compson stood watching her as she mounted, steadying herself against the wall with one hand, holding her skirts up with the other.
"Are you going to wake him up just to dress him?" she said.
Dilsey stopped. With her foot lifted to the next step, she stood there, her hand against the wall and the gray splash of the window behind her. Motionless and shapeless, she loomed. "He ain't awake, then?" she said.
"He wasn't when I looked in," Mrs. Compson said. "But it's past his time. He never does sleep after 7:30. You know he doesn't."
Dilsey said nothing. She made no further move, but though she could not see her save as a blobby shape without depth, Mrs. Compson knew that she had lowered her face a little, and that she stood now like cows do in the rain, holding the empty water bottle by its neck.
"You're not the one who has to bear it," Mrs. Compson said. "It's not your responsibility. You can go away. You don't have to bear the brunt of it day in and day out. You owe nothing to them, to Mr. Compson's memory. I know you have never had any tenderness for Jason. You've never tried to conceal it."
Dilsey said nothing. She turned slowly and descended, lowering her body from step to step as a small child does, her hand against the wall.
"You go on and let him alone," she said. "Don't go in dar no more now. I'll send Luster up soon as I find him. Let him alone now."
She returned to the kitchen. She looked into the stove, then she drew her apron over her head and donned the overcoat and opened the outer door and looked up and down the yard. The weather drove upon her flesh, harsh and minute, but the scene was empty of all else that moved. She descended the steps gingerly, as if for silence, and went around the corner of the kitchen. As she did so, Luster emerged quickly and innocently from the cellar door. Dilsey stopped.
"What you up to?" she says.
"Nothing," Luster said. "Mr. Jason say for me to find out whar dat water leak in the cellar from."
"And when was it he say for you to do dat?" Dilsey said. "Last New Year's Day, wasn't it?"
"I thought I'd just be looking whilst they sleep," Luster said.
Dilsey went to the cellar door. He stood aside, and she peered down into the obscurity, odorous of dank earth and mold and rubber.
"Huh," Dilsey said.
She looked at Luster again. He met her gaze blandly, innocent and open.
"I don't know what you up to, but you ain't got no business doing it. You just trying me too this morning, 'cause the others is, ain't you? You get on up dar and see to Benji, you hear?"
"Yes'm," Luster said.
He went on toward the kitchen steps, swiftly.
"Here," Dilsey said, "you get me another armful of wood while I got you."
"Yes'm," he said.
He passed her on the steps and went to the woodpile. When he blundered again at the door a moment later, again invisible and blind within and beyond his wooden avatar, Dilsey opened the door and guided him across the kitchen with a firm hand.
"Just throw it at that box again," she said. "Just throw it."
"I got to," Luster said, panting. "I can't put it down no other way."
"Then you stand there and hold it a while," Dilsey said.
She unloaded him a stick at a time.
"What got into you this morning? Here I sent you for wood, and you ain't never bought more than 6 sticks at a time to save your life for the day. What you fixin' to ask me can you do now? Ain't that show left town yet?"
"Yes'm, it done gone."
She put the last stick into the box.
"Now you go on up dar with Benji like I told you before," she said. "And I don't want nobody else yellin' down them stairs at me twell I rings the bell. You hear me?"
"Yes'm,"
Luster said. He vanished through the swing door. Dilsey put some more wood in the stove and returned to the breadboard. Presently she began to sing again. The room grew warmer. Soon Dilsey's skin had taken on a rich, lustrous quality as compared with that as of a faint dusting of wood ashes which both it and Luster's had worn as she moved about the kitchen, gathering about her the raw materials of food, coordinating the meal. On the wall above a cupboard, invisible save at night, by lamplight, and even then evincing an enigmatic profundity because it had but one hand, a cabinet clock ticked. Then, with a preliminary sound as if it had cleared its throat, struck 5 times.
8 o'clock, Dilsey said.
She ceased and tilted her head upward, listening, but there was no sound save the clock and the fire. She opened the oven and looked at the pan of bread, then stooping she paused while someone descended the stairs. She heard the feet cross the dining room, then the swing door opened and Luster entered, followed by a big man who appeared to have been shaped of some substance whose particles would not or did not cohere to one another or to the frame which supported it. His skin was dead-looking and hairless. Dropsical, too, he moved with a shambling gait like a trained bear. His hair was pale and fine. It had been brushed smoothly down upon his brow like that of children in daguerreotypes. His eyes were clear, of the pale sweet blue of cornflowers. His thick mouth hung open, drooling a little. "Is he cold?" Dilsey said. She wiped her hands on her apron and touched his hand. "If he ain't, I is," Luster said. "Always cold Easter. Ain't never seen it fail. Miss Caroline say if you ain't got time to fix a hot water bottle, then never mind about it." "Oh, Lord," Dilsey said. She drew a chair into the corner between the woodbox and the stove. The man went obediently and sat in it. "Look in the dining room and see where I laid that bottle down," Dilsey said. Luster fetched the bottle from the dining room, and Dilsey filled it and gave it to him. "Hurry up now," she said. "See if Jason wake now. Tell him it's all ready." Luster went out. Ben sat beside the stove. He sat loosely, utterly motionless, save for his head, which made a continual bobbing sort of movement, as he watched Dilsey with his sweet, vague gaze as she moved about. Luster returned. "He up," he said. "Miss Caroline say put it on the table." He came to the stove and spread his hands palm down above the firebox. "He up, too," he said. "Gwine hit with both feet this morning." "What's the matter now?" Dilsey said. "Get away from dar. How can I do anything with you standing over the stove?" "I cold," Luster said. "You ought to thought about that whilst you was down dar in that cellar," Dilsey said. "What the matter with Jason?" "Saying me and Benji broke that winder in his room." "Is day one broke?" Dilsey said. "That's what he's saying," Luster said. "Say I broke it." "How could you when he keep it locked all day and night?" "Say I broke it chunking rocks at it," Luster said. "And did you?" "No'm," Luster said. "Don't lie to me, boy," Dilsey said. "I never done it," Luster said. "Ask Benji if I did." "I ain't studying that winder." "Who could have broke it then?" Dilsey said. "He just trying hisself to wake Quentin up," she said, taking the pan of biscuits out of the stove. "Reckon so," Luster said. "These funny folks. Glad I ain't none of them." "Ain't none of who?" Dilsey said. "Let me tell you something, nigger boy. You got just as much Compson devilment in you as any of them. Is you right sure you never broke that window?" "What I want to break it fur?" "What do you do any of your devilment fur?" Dilsey said. "Watch him now so he can't burn his hand again twell I get the table set." She went to the dining room, where they heard her moving about. Then she returned and set a plate at the kitchen table and set food there. Ben watched her, slobbering, making a faint, eager sound. "All right, honey," she said. "Here your breakfast. Bring his chair, Luster." Luster moved the chair up, and Ben sat down, whimpering and slobbering. Dilsey tied a cloth about his neck and wiped his mouth with the end of it. "And see can you keep from messing up his clothes one time," she said, handing Luster a spoon. Ben ceased whimpering. He watched the spoon as it rose to his mouth. It was as if even eagerness were muscle-bound in him, too, and hunger itself inarticulate, not knowing it as hunger. Luster fed him with skill and attachment. Now and then his attention would return long enough to enable him to feint the spoon and cause Ben to close his mouth upon the empty air, but it was apparent that Luster's mind was elsewhere. His other hand lay on the back of the chair, and upon that dead surface it moved tentatively, delicately, as if he were picking an inaudible tune out of the dead void. And once he even forgot to tease Ben with the spoon while his fingers teased out of the slain wood a soundless and involved arpeggio until Ben recalled him by whimpering again. In the dining room, Dilsey moved back and forth. Presently, she rang a small, clear bell. Then in the kitchen, Luster heard Mrs. Compson and Jason descending, and Jason's voice, and he rolled his eyes whitely while listening. "Sure I know they didn't break it," Jason said. "Sure I know that. Maybe the change of weather broke it." "I don't see how it could have," Mrs. Compson said. "Your room stays locked all day long, just as you leave it when you go to town. None of us ever go in there except Sunday to clean it. I don't want you to think that I would go where I'm not wanted or that I would permit anyone else to." "I never said you broke it, did I?" Jason said. "I don't want to go in your room," Mrs. Compson said. "I respect anybody's private affairs.
I wouldn't put my foot over the threshold, even if I had a key.
Yes, Jason said, I know your keys won't fit. That's why I had the lock changed. What I want to know is how that window got broken.
Lust to say he didn't do it, Dilsey said.
I knew that without asking him, Jason said. Where's Quentin? He said.
Where she is every Sunday morning, Dilsey said. What got into you the last few days anyhow?
Well, we're going to change all that, Jason said. Go up and tell her breakfast is ready.
You leave her alone now, Jason, Dilsey said. She gets up for breakfast every week morning, and Miss Caroline lets her stay in bed every Sunday. You knows that.
I can't keep a kitchen full of niggers to wait on her pleasure much as I'd like to, Jason said. Go and tell her to come down to breakfast.
Ain't nobody have to wait on her, Dilsey said. I puts her breakfast in the warmer, and she...
Did you hear me? Jason said.
I hears you, Dilsey said. All I've been hearing when you in the house. If it ain't Quentin or your ma, it's Lust and Benji. What you let him go on that way for, Miss Caroline?
You better do as he says, Mrs. Compson said. He's head of the house now. It's his right to require us to respect his wishes. I try to do it, and if I can, you can too.
'Tain't no sense in him being so bad-tempered he got to make Quentin get up just to suit him, Dilsey said. Maybe you think she broke that window.
She would if she happened to think of it, Jason said. You go and do what I told you.
And I wouldn't blame her none if she did, Dilsey said, going toward the stairs. With you nagging at her all the blessed time you in the house.
Hush, Dilsey, Mrs. Compson said.
It's neither your place nor mine to tell Jason what to do. Sometimes I think he is wrong, but I try to obey his wishes for you all's sake. If I'm strong enough to come to the table, Quentin can too.
Dilsey went out. They heard her mounting the stairs. They heard her a long while on the stairs.
You've got a prize set of servants, Jason said. He helped his mother and himself to food. Did you ever have one that was worth killing? You must have had some before I was big enough to remember.
I have to humor them, Mrs. Compson said. I have to depend on them so completely. It's not as if I was strong. I wish I were. I wish I could do all the housework myself. I could at least take that much off your shoulders.
And a fine pigsty we'd live in, too, Jason said.
Hurry up, Dilsey, he shouted.
I know you blame me, Mrs. Compson said, for letting them off to go to church today.
Go where? Jason said. Hasn't that damn show left yet?
To church, Mrs. Compson said. The darkies are having a special Easter service. I promised Dilsey 2 weeks ago that they could get off.
Which means we'll eat cold dinner, Jason said, or none at all.
I know it's my fault, Mrs. Compson said. I know you blame me.
For what? Jason said. You never resurrected Christ, did you?
They heard Dilsey mount the final stair, then her slow feet overhead.
Quentin, she said.
When she called the first time, Jason laid his knife and fork down, and he and his mother appeared to wait across the table from one another in identical attitudes. The one cold and shrewd, with close-thatched brown hair curled into two stubborn hooks, one on either side of his forehead like a bartender in caricature, and hazel eyes with black-ringed irises like marbles. The other cold and querulous, with perfectly white hair and eyes pouched and baffled and so dark as to appear to be all pupil or all iris.
"Quentin," Dilsey said, "get up, honey. They waitin' breakfast on you."
"I can't understand how that window got broken," Mrs. Compson said. "Are you sure it was done yesterday? It could have been like that a long time with the warm weather. The upper sash behind the shade like that."
"I've told you for the last time that it happened yesterday," Jason said. "Don't you reckon I know the room I live in? Do you reckon I could have lived in it a week with a hole in the window you could stick your hand?"
His voice ceased, ebbed, left him staring at his mother with eyes that for an instant were quite empty of anything. It was as though his eyes were holding their breath while his mother looked at him, her face flaccid and querulous, interminable, clairvoyant yet obtuse. As they sat so, Dilsey said,
"Quentin, don't play with me, honey. Come on to breakfast, honey. They waiting for you."
"I can't understand it," Mrs. Compson said. "It's just as if somebody had tried to break into the house."
Jason sprang up. His chair crashed over backward.
"What?"
Mrs. Compson said, staring at him as he ran past her and went jumping up the stairs where he met Dilsey. His face was now in shadow, and Dilsey said, "She's sullen.
Your ma ain't unlocked.
But Jason ran on past her and along the corridor to a door. He didn't call. He grasped the knob and tried it. Then he stood with the knob in his hand and his head bent a little, as if he were listening to something much further away than the dimensioned room beyond the door, and which he already heard. His attitude was that of one who goes through the motions of listening in order to deceive himself as to what he already hears. Behind him, Mrs. Compson mounted the stairs, calling his name. Then she saw Dilsey, and she quit calling him and began to call Dilsey instead.
"I told you she ain't unlocked that door yet," Dilsey said.
When she spoke, he turned and ran toward her, but his voice was quiet, matter-of-fact. "She carry the key with her?" he said. "Has she got it now, I mean, or will she have—"
"Dilsey," Mrs. Compson said on the stairs.
"Is which?" Dilsey said.
"Why don't you let the key," Jason said, "to that room? Does she carry it with her all the time?"
"Mother?"
Then he saw Mrs. Compson, and he went down the stairs and met her. "Give me the key," he said. He fell to pawing at the pockets of the rusty black dressing sack she wore. She resisted.
"Jason," she said. "Jason, are you and Dilsey trying to put me to bed again?"
she said, trying to fend him off.
"Can't you even let me have Sunday in peace?"
"The key," Jason said, pawing at her. "Give it here."
He looked back at the door as if he expected it to fly open before he could get back to it with the key he did not yet have.
"You, Dilsey," Mrs. Compson said, clutching her sack about her.
"Give me the key, you old fool," Jason cried suddenly.
From her pocket he tugged a huge bunch of rusted keys on an iron ring like a medieval jailer's, and ran back up the hall with the two women behind him.
"You, Jason," Mrs. Compson said.
"He will never find the right one," she said.
"You know I never let anyone take my keys, Dilsey," she said.
She began to wail.
"Hush," Dilsey said. "He ain't gwine to do nothing to her. I ain't gwine to let him."
"But on Sunday morning in my own house," Mrs. Compson said, "when I've tried so hard to raise them Christians.
Let me find the right key, Jason," she said.
She put her hand on his arm. Then she began to struggle with him, but he flung her aside with a motion of his elbow and looked around at her for a moment, his eyes cold and harried. Then he turned to the door again and the unwieldy keys.
"Hush," Dilsey said. "You, Jason."
"Something terrible has happened," Mrs. Compson said, wailing again. "I know it has. You, Jason," she said, grasping at him again. "He won't even let me find the key to a room in my own house."
"Now, now," Dilsey said, "what can happen?"
"I right here. I ain't gwine let him hurt her. Quentin," she said, raising her voice, "don't you be scared, honey. I's right here."
The door opened, swung inward. He stood in it for a moment, hiding the room. Then he stepped aside. "Go in," he said in a thick, light voice. They went in. It was not a girl's room. It was not anybody's room. And the faint scent of cheap cosmetics and a few feminine objects and the other evidences of crude and hopeless efforts to feminize it, but added to its anonymity, giving it that dead and stereotyped transience of rooms in assignation houses. The bed had not been disturbed. On the floor lay a soiled undergarment of cheap silk, a little too pink. From a half-open bureau drawer dangled a single stocking. The window was open. A pear tree grew there, close against the house. It was in bloom, and the branches scraped and rasped against the house, and the myriad air, driving in the window, brought into the room the forlorn scent of the blossoms.
"Dar now," Dilsey said. "Didn't I told you she all right?"
"All right," Mrs. Compson said.
Dilsey followed her into the room and touched her.
"You come on and lay down now," she said. "I'll find her in 10 minutes.
Mrs. Compson shook her off.
"Find the note," she said. "Quentin left a note when he did it."
"All right," Dilsey said. "I'll find it. You come on to your room now."
"I knew the minute they named her Quentin this would happen," Mrs. Compson said.
She went to the bureau and began to turn over the scattered objects there. Scent bottles, a box of powder, a chewed pencil, a pair of scissors with one broken blade lying upon a darned scarf dusted with powder and stained with rouge.
"Find the note," she said.
"I is," Dilsey said. "You come on now. Me and Jason'll find it. You come on to your room."
"Jason," Mrs. Compson said,
"where is he?"
She went to the door. Dilsey followed her on down the hall to another door. It was closed.
"Jason,"
she called through the door. There was no answer. She tried the knob.
Then she called him again. But there was still no answer, for he was hurling things backward out of the closet, garments, shoes, a suitcase. Then he emerged, carrying a sawn section of tongue-and-groove planking, and laid it down, and entered the closet again and emerged with a metal box. He set it on the bed, and stood looking at the broken lock while he dug a key-ring from his pocket and selected a key. And for a time longer he stood with the selected key in his hand, looking at the broken lock. Then he put the keys back in his pocket and carefully tilted the contents of the box out upon the bed. Still carefully he sorted the papers, taking them up one at a time and shaking them. Then he upended the box and shook it too, and slowly replaced the papers, and stood again, looking at the broken lock, with the box in his hands and his head bent. Outside the window he heard some jaybirds swirl, shrieking, past and away, their cries whipping away along the wind, and an automobile passed somewhere and died away also. His mother spoke his name again beyond the door, but he didn't move. He heard Dilsey lead her away up the hall, and then a door closed. Then he replaced the box in the closet and flung the garments back into it, and went downstairs to the telephone. While he stood there with the receiver to his ear waiting, Dilsey came down the stairs. She looked at him, without stopping, and went on. The wire opened.
"This is Jason Compson," he said, his voice so harsh and thick that he had to repeat himself. "Jason Compson," he said, controlling his voice. "Have a car ready with a deputy if you can't go in 10 minutes. I'll be there." "What? Robbery. My house. I know who it... Robbery, I say. Have a car re... What? Aren't you a paid law enforcement?" "Yes, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Have that car ready to leave at once. If you don't, I'll report it to the governor."
He clapped the receiver back and crossed the dining room, where the scarce broken meal lay cold now on the table, and entered the kitchen. Dilsey was filling the hot water bottle. Ben sat, tranquil and empty. Beside him, Luster looked like a feist dog, brightly watchful. He was eating something. Jason went on across the kitchen.
"Ain't you gonna eat no breakfast?" Dilsey said.
He paid her no attention.
"Go on in and eat your breakfast, Jason."
He went on. The outer door banged behind him. Luster rose and went to the window and looked out.
"Whew," he said. "What happening up dar? He been beating Miss Quentin?"
"You hush your mouth," Dilsey said. "You get Benji started now and I beat your head off. You keep him quiet as you can twell I get back now." She screwed the cap on the bottle and went out. They heard her go up the stairs. Then they heard Jason pass the house in his car. There was no sound in the kitchen save the simmering murmur of the kettle and the clock.
"You know what I bet?" Luster said. "I bet he beat her. I bet he knock her in the head, and now he gone for the doctor. That's what I bet."
The clock tick-tocked, solemn and profound. It might have been the dry pulse of the decaying house itself. After a while it whirred and cleared its throat and struck 6 times. Ben looked up at it, then he looked at the bullet-like silhouette of Luster's head in the window, and he began to bob his head again, drooling. He whimpered.
"Hush up, loony," Luster said, without turning. "Look like we ain't going to get to go to no church today."
But Ben sat in the chair, his big soft hands dangling between his knees, moaning faintly. Suddenly he wept, a slow bellowing sound, meaningless and sustained.
"Hush," Luster said.
He turned and lifted his hand.
"You want me to whoop you?"
But Ben looked at him, bellowing slowly with each expiration. Luster came and shook him.
"You hush this minute," he shouted.
"Here," he said. He hauled Ben out of the chair and dragged the chair around facing the stove and opened the door to the firebox and shoved Ben into the chair. They looked like a tug nudging at a clumsy tanker in a narrow dock. Ben sat down again facing the rosy door. He hushed. Then they heard the clock again and Dilsey slow on the stairs. When she entered, he began to whimper again. Then he lifted his voice.
"What you done to him?" Dilsey said. "Why can't you let him alone this morning of all times?"
"I ain't done nothing to him," Luster said. "Mr. Jason scared him. That's what it is. He ain't killed Miss Quentin, is he?"
"Hush, Benji," Dilsey said.
He hushed. She went to the window and looked out.
"Is it quit rainin'?" she said.
"Yes'm,"
Luster said. Quit long time ago. Then you all go outdoors a while, she said. I just got Miss Caroline quiet now.
Is we gwine to church?
Luster said. I'll let you know about that when the time come. You keep him away from the house till I calls you.
Can we go to the pasture?
Luster said. All right, only you keep him away from the house. I done stood all I can.
Yes'm, Luster said.
Why Mr. Jason gone, mammy?
That's some all your business, ain't it?
Dilsey said. She began to clear the table.
Hush, Benji. Luster gwine take you out to play.
What he done to Miss Quentin, mammy? Luster said.
Ain't done nothing to her. You all get on out in here.
I bet she ain't here, Luster said.
Dilsey looked at him. How you know she ain't here?
Me and Benji seed her climb out the window last night. Didn't us, Benji?
You did, Dilsey said, looking at him.
We sees her doing hit every night, Luster said. Climb right down that pear tree.
Don't you lie to me, nigger boy, Dilsey said.
I ain't lying. Ask Benji if I is.
Why don't you say something about it then?
'Twan't none of my business, Luster said.
I ain't gwine to get mixed up in white folks' business.
Come on here, Benji. Let's go outdoors.
They went out. Dilsey stood for a while at the table. Then she went and cleared the breakfast things from the dining room and ate her breakfast and cleaned up the kitchen. Then she removed her apron and hung it up and went to the foot of the stairs and listened for a moment. There was no sound. She donned the overcoat and the hat and went across to her cabin. The rain had stopped. The air now drove out of the southeast, broken overhead into blue patches. Upon the crest of a hill beyond the trees and roofs and spires of town, sunlight lay like a pale scrap of cloth, was blotted away. Upon the air a bell came, then, as if at a signal, other bells took up the sound and repeated it. The cabin door opened and Dilsey emerged, again in the maroon cape and the purple gown, and wearing soiled white elbow-length gloves and minus her headcloth now. She came into the yard and called Luster. She waited a while, then she went to the house and around it to the cellar door, moving close to the wall, and looked into the door. Ben sat on the steps. Before him, Luster squatted on the damp floor. He held a saw in his left hand, the blade sprung a little by pressure of his hand, and he was in the act of striking the blade with the worn wooden mallet with which she had been making beaten biscuit for more than 30 years. The saw gave forth a single sluggish twang that ceased with lifeless alacrity, leaving the blade in a thin, clean curve between Luster's hand and the floor. Still, inscrutable, it bellied.
"That's the way he done it," Luster said. "I just ain't found the right thing to hit it with."
"That's what you doing, is it?" Dilsey said. "Bring me that mallet," she said.
"I ain't heard it," Luster said.
"Bring it here," Dilsey said. "Put that saw where you got it first."
He put the saw away and brought the mallet to her. Then Ben wailed again, hopeless and prolonged. It was nothing, just sound. It might have been all time and injustice and sorrow become vocal for an instant by a conjunction of planets.
"Listen at him," Luster said. "He been gwine on that way ever since you sent us out in the house. I don't know what got into him this morning."
"Bring him here," Dilsey said.
"Come on, Benji," Luster said.
He went back down the steps and took Ben's arm. He came obediently, wailing, that slow, hoarse sound that ships make, that seems to begin before the sound itself has started, seems to cease before the sound itself has stopped.
"Run and get his cap," Dilsey said. "Don't make no noise Miss Caroline can hear. Hurry now, we already late."
"She gwine hear him anyhow if you don't stop him,"